This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Things aren't always what they seem to be, and that was the case with the story of WedTech. It started as a small tool and die company in the South Bronx. With the help of the Small Business Administration's special set-aside program for minority-run businesses, the company grew in the early 80s to become a $100 million defense contractor. President Reagan described the company's co-founder, John Mariotta, as a hero for the 80s. But WedTech became one of the scandals of the Reagan era, with links to presidential aide Lynn Nofziger and Attorney General Edwin Meese. WedTech's success, it turned out, was the result of bribery, influence peddling, and fraud. The WedTech story is the subject of the new book, Too Good to Be True. My guest is the author, James Traub. He's written about crime, business, and politics for The New York Times, The New Republic, and Spy magazine. I asked Traub what he thinks the WedTech story is really about.
Well, it's about several things. To me, at the broadest level, it's about human nature. One of the things that I found fascinating about WedTech was that here was a group of people, the fellows who ran this company, who in effect went through the world asking for people to join them in their corrupt crusade. That is, they enlisted the help of politicians and of lawyers and of accountants and of government officials and of all sorts of people, very prestigious. And the remarkable thing is, no one said no, or I should say scarcely anyone said no. In the perennial contest that WedTech created between the rules and self-interest, self-interest always won out, and it was a comment on the ingenuity of the company that they were always able to put things in such a way that they could get the help of others. At the political level, I think I actually am a little bit shocked that people were so indifferent to the rules. People were always willing to bend the rules. The Reagan administration helped WedTech in any number of ways, and I think in some ways violated its own professed belief in the free market by allowing WedTech to essentially trample on the rules of that marketplace.
WedTech got started through a loan from the Small Business Association. This was a set-aside program, a program for minorities. Was WedTech really minority-owned?
Well, that's one of its many, many frauds they committed. And I should add, by the way, that this program you've mentioned, which is called the 8A program, was created to help minorities get started in a relatively non-competitive atmosphere in minority businesses. It was always afflicted with fraud. There were all sorts of companies that not only weren't owned by minorities, they only had a front man, a fellow who simply signed his name. WedTech was not really owned more than 50% by a minority member, but I must say, in that regard, they were less flagrant than a lot of other violators of that program. They claimed to be owned two-thirds by a fellow of Hispanic origin named John Mariotta. In fact, Mariotta only owned half of the company, and they pretended to own two-thirds in order to get into the program.
Tell us a little bit about how WedTech got started and what WedTech was in its early days.
In its early days, WedTech was something wonderful. And it's odd for me to say that, given that people think of it only as this byword for corruption. But WedTech, not only in its early days, but always, was a company which had a strong kernel, a core of idealism and a kind of crusading quality. It began as a little machine shop in the South Bronx, and everyone knows, I guess, by now that the South Bronx is the sort of symbol for the blighted urban ghetto, and especially in the mid-60s when WedTech started up. It was a disaster area, and here was this remarkable little company at that time making things like baby carriage equipment in the midst of this awful slum. I visited it myself in 1978 when I was just a reporter. And I saw this remarkable little factory, machine shop in this awful area, and I was just struck by how wonderful it was. And I was one of the many reporters who wrote articles extolling the virtues of this firm. And so it remained for the first 5 or 10 years, run by this fellow John Mariotta, a very, very odd fellow, but a wonderful mechanic, a man who really had genius in his hands as a tool and die man. Who was later joined by another rather odd fellow, a fellow named Fred Neuberger, who was a Holocaust escapee from Romania, later a terrorist or freedom fighter for Israel in its war for independence against the British. And these two fellows slowly built up the company its initial years and then got wind of this set-aside program that we've discussed, and all of a sudden through that program began to get very large government contracts aided by the political influence for which they later became infamous, and all of a sudden grew from this tiny little machine shop to a very large, at least by the standards of a place like the South Bronx, a very large defense contractor.
How did they get into the defense business?
Well, you know, The principal agency of government in terms of letting contracts is the Defense Department. So for most of the firms that join the set-aside program, their goal is to get some kind of contract with the Pentagon. Now, for the vast majority of those firms, the work they do are primarily in service industries. For example, food service. And I think a lot of minority businessmen feel that the racism of the military manifests itself in the form of giving them these not very advanced, not very sophisticated sort of contracts. WEDTEC was relatively unusual in that they did relatively complex metal fabrication work, and there were not a lot of competitive firms, even within the set-aside program, that could do the same kind of work they did. And such competition as there was, WEDTEC always managed to annihilate by means of their political influence. So after getting some multi-million dollar contracts, $3, $4, $5, $6, $7 million, in 1982, they managed, by basically steamrolling all opposition inside the uniformed army, to get a contract to build engines for field generators for the army, which ultimately totaled almost $28 million, and that really sent them on their way.
My guest is James Traub, and his new book, Too Good to Be True, is the story of WEDTEC. You've been referring to the political influence that that they used to help them grow and to help get Defense Department contracts. Where did that start?
Well, as in all things, WEDTEC started small and then built their way up with remarkable speed and ambition. It started when Mario Biaggi, who is now languishing in jail but was then a congressman from the Bronx, paid a visit to the company in 1978. Now, WEDTEC, though, in the Bronx, was not in his constituency. It was in the adjacent one. But Biaggi, at that time, also had a law firm going, as well as being a congressman, which was not, by the way, illegal then. It isn't now, though it would be harder to do. And Biaggi let them know that it would be in their interest to become clients of his law firm. And their response was, we don't need a lawyer. But they were smart enough to see that it wasn't exactly legal work that he had in mind. It was political representation. So they retained the Biaggi firm, and Biaggi and his then-partner, Bernard Ehrlich, essentially began helping WEDTEC at the local level with problems that they had in New York, and probably provided enough service to justify the amount that WEDTEC was paying them. From there, WEDTEC started to move into higher spheres of political influence. They also made payments, and payments that were later found to be corrupt, to the congressman who did represent them, Robert Garcia. Likewise, with the borough president of the Bronx, Stanley Simon. Both of those fellows were later convicted for receiving those money, though Garcia's conviction was overturned on appeal. From there, they went up to the national level. And they became sizable political contributors, essentially doing just the same thing that all of the big defense contractors do. WEDTEC was always intensely conscious of following along the lead they found in the world outside them. And they knew that the way you got contracts, if you were a McDonnell Douglas or a Grumman, was to give lots of money to the important congressional officials and also to hire as many former Pentagon bigwigs as you could. So WEDTEC focused in terms of its political contributions, and I should make it clear that there's nothing illegal per se about political contributions, on Alphonse D'Amato, who is, of course, a senator from New York and an influential person. And over the years, WEDTEC gave him at least $30,000 and perhaps more. And D'Amato always went to bat for the company and never questioned its bona fides and became a very important player. From there, WEDTEC moved up into the ultimate big leagues of the Reagan administration.
Yeah, well, people like Lynn Nofziger and Ed Meese were implicated in the WEDTEC scandal. What was Lynn Nofziger's role, and how did he get involved? What was in it for him?
Money. Originally, what WEDTEC offered to Reagan officials was simply the political image, which, after all, is not an inconsiderable thing, of a company doing just what President Reagan said minority companies and minorities in general should do, which is pulling itself up by its bootstraps. The fact is, WEDTEC was doing no such thing. It was maneuvering the political system with tremendous ingenuity and cheating left and right. But it gave the impression of being a kind of a symbol for the success of the free enterprise system. So this was something that the administration could champion, and indeed that's what President Reagan had in mind when he referred to John Marietta as a hero for the 80s. So WEDTEC, when trying to get this engine contract that I've mentioned, went to the administration, had the clever idea of taking out an advertisement in which the company, and through a Latin American Manufacturing Association, a lobbying group, stood up and said that it favored the new Reagan administration economic plan in 1981. So they knew how to get on board and support the administration agenda. They appealed to Lynn Nofziger, who was then not only Reagan's very close friend, but his chief political operative, to help them get this contract. And Nofziger didn't do that much until the spring of 1982, when he quit government service and became, as so many important government officials do, became a lobbyist, essentially lobbying his own former colleagues in government. One of his first clients was WedTech, though it was actually disguised. The client was this Hispanic lobbying organization, but it really was WedTech. And Nofziger then went to his old friend, Ed Meese, also President Reagan's old friend, and said, "Ed, it would be a big political blunder if we don't give this contract to WedTech. The symbolism is very important." And Meese didn't do very much. All he did was he went to some of his associates, his aides, he then being the White House counselor, and said something to the effect of, "Keep an eye on these fellows. Let's make sure the process doesn't go awry." Well, when you're Ed Meese, that's not very much different from saying, "Let's make sure these guys get their contract." And by the spring of 1982, Meese's chief aide, a fellow named Jim Jenkins, had basically called all the military officials together who were resisting WedTech and basically said, "Cut it out, fellas. Give these guys the contract." And at that point, the Army said, "Well, we've got our marching orders. We did our best to resist. We don't think this company should build the engines, but we'll give them the contract." And they did. And that pattern repeated itself several times over in terms of pressure from the Reagan administration.
You were talking about how the Reagan administration liked the sound of this company because it seemed to represent the kind of free enterprise that the Reagan administration was behind. Now, you also say that you think that Republicans saw Hispanics more than blacks as natural Republicans.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, this was explained to me by a very learned political official, Ed Rollins.
Let me interrupt here.
Yes.
That the reason why I'm bringing this up is because John Mariotto, who was one of the founders of WedTech, is Hispanic.
Yes, that's right. He was Hispanic, and their company was a set-aside program because it was run by a Hispanic. And Ed Rollins, who came to replace Lynn Nofziger when he left as the chief political operative, explained to me when I came to talk to him that the Republicans had decided that Hispanics being culturally more conservative, I think this was the phrase they used, had a natural sense of affinity with the Republican Party that perhaps blacks did not. Blacks having a sense of grievance, which led them to favor more government, whereas Hispanics might actually have a more libertarian point of view. And I believe that to some extent, voting patterns bear that out, though not nearly as much as Republicans have hoped. So this set-aside program has always had a political function. In the Nixon days, its function was to create the black middle class, which President Nixon always spoke about. In the Reagan administration, even though the Reaganites, of course, believed in free enterprise and therefore presumably would not believe in the kind of affirmative action program that the set-aside program really was, Nevertheless, never called for its abolition, or at least not until quite late in the game, and tried to use it to bolster their standing amongst Hispanics, and in fact replaced many blacks in the ranks of the program with Hispanic officials.
You were talking about the way the Reagan administration used WedTech as exemplifying some of the administration's own business goals and orientation. How did WedTech fit into the Reagan administration's plans for enterprise zones?
Well, there's a wonderful story that, in fact, I start my book off with, in which John Mariotto, who, again, was the chairman of the company and was almost illiterate and oddly enough, really didn't speak either English or Spanish very well. I can vouch for his English, and I've been told that his Spanish wasn't all that terrific, who really was a strange, trapped, in some ways quite brilliant and also paranoid fellow, was invited to the White House in order to be present at a symposium that was being held as a kind of pep rally for the Enterprise Zone. You'll remember that the Urban Enterprise Zone was the Reagan administration's one and only effort to do something about the problems of inner-city poverty. So Mariotta, as an exemplar of the idea of free enterprise in the ghetto and of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, was invited to be at the symposium. And the poor fellow was, I think, genuinely terrified. He'd never been in the White House. He didn't really know prominent people like that. And he sat in this meeting, of which there's a wonderful photograph, the chandeliers glittering on the table. He sat there fiddling and feeling terrified. But he's also an evangelical personality. He's a person with a fanatical belief in himself. He always had this belief even after all of his crimes were revealed. And finally, he burst out and began speaking. And he then delivered a monologue of maybe 20 minutes in which he implored the president, who was sitting there, to get the opium of welfare off the taxpayers' backs by emulating the example of WedTech. And he spoke on and on about WedTech. And a number of the people I've spoken to said they thought this was a charming person, but about halfway to being a nutcase. And there's a photograph of this event where you can see various luminaries like Treasury Secretary Donald Regan or Congressman Barbara Conable looking in boredom and perplexity at this fellow. And there is Ronald Reagan, rapt. John Mariotta is leaning forward, expostulating. President Reagan is leaning forward. The light has fallen onto his face. He's gazing at John Mariotta. And to me, this represents the transmission of a fantasy from one dreamer to another. I think both Mariotta and Reagan were people who lived more in the realm of magic than the realm of reason. And I think President Reagan had a kind of instant affinity for not only John Mariotta, but a lot of other people like him, people who told wonderful stories of delightful things that just ought to be true. And in these people's mouths, it was true. And President Reagan could then believe that it was true and recite back to the American people the stories he'd been told, as he did when he spoke of John Mariotta as a hero for the 80s. So Mariotta not only proved to Reagan's mind, I suppose, that these ideas were true, he was a physical narrative embodiment of the idea of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and eschewing welfare.
Do you see WedTech as a company that started off honest and then through learning how to play the game got corrupt?
Yeah, I think that these fellows did not originally plan on doing anything corrupt. They simply wouldn't let the company die and they wouldn't let anything stand in its way. They were all originally fueled by the hopes of doing something grand. And indeed, I went to see this company, and if anybody else went to see it, and many did, they were stunned by the vision of a gleaming factory floor with the most modern computer-controlled equipment turning out quite sophisticated machinery in the midst of this devastated environment of the South Bronx, with rotting cars sitting on the corner and winos and just that overall air of helplessness. Here was something fabulous. Here was a dream. And it was real. And to some extent, it was always real. What happened was, first, they committed crimes to prevent the company from going out of business. Once they had done that, they committed crimes to increase its prospects, to get new contracts. And once they had done that, they committed crimes to simply out of greed, just to get money. Once they had started on it, there was never any turning back. And I think their sensibilities got hardened very quickly.
How did they learn the ropes? How did they learn which crimes to commit to keep solvent?
They had a lot of help. An interesting moment came in 1983 when the company had decided to go public. They finally, when you go public, you have to open up your books to the world, auditors, lawyers, bankers, and so on, as well as potential investors. The auditors came, big auditing firm called Main Herdman, no longer in existence. And they discovered very rapidly that WedTech had defrauded the Defense Department back in 1980 and had kept doing so to the tune of as much as $6 million. That was their first big crime, and they had done it to basically keep from going bankrupt. Well, they thought, the jig is up. We won't be able to have a public offering. They may expose us to the world. The company is going to fall apart in no time. But it turned out, and this is alleged, it has not yet been proved in court and may never be, it turned out that the chief auditor sent over by this firm said to them, well, wait a minute, I think we can solve this. And they reached, according to the WedTech officials, they reached an agreement. They would later hire this fellow for an enormous amount of money and a huge block of stock. And he, in turn, would explain the whole thing to his superiors back at the accounting firm in such a way that they would say, okay, here's the slap on the wrist, life can go on. And that's precisely what happened. So the point of that story is that WedTech was always learning from its environment. These fellows were clever learners. And they found that as long as you knew the method and as long as you knew the coin in which to pay people, you could always find a way of doing whatever you had to do to get ahead.
The example that you mentioned of defrauding the Defense Department of $6 million?
Yes.
What was that for?
Well, that was their first big crime. Back to 1980, still a small company. As always, there was a cash flow shortage. They desperately tried to find funds. They couldn't. Everything failed. It was late in 1980, and a fellow who was an accountant pointed out to one of the fellows who ran the company, a fellow named Mario Marino, that he had inadvertently, he said, submitted invoices to the Pentagon for work that they had not yet done. Nobody asked any questions. They had been quickly reimbursed. Well, this suggested a method to these fellows. Why don't they just start phonying up invoices and get paid for work before they do it? In effect, they wouldn't actually get ultimately more money, but they would increase their cash flow. They'd earn interest on the money before they had a right to get it. Well, they seriously debated this. It was their first obvious big fraud against the government. And it was a snowy day in December, and they argued back and forth, and a sense of despair hung over them all. And finally, they all said, it's this or we're going out of business. And I think other companies would have said, well, we obviously can't cheat the government. We've got to go out of business. These fellows said, if that's the choice, we'll cheat the government. And that was the beginning for them. And I think after that, the debates got much shorter.
James Traub is my guest, and he's written a new book about the WedTech scandal. Who did you speak to, protagonists in the WedTech story? Who was willing to talk to you?
Well, that was a big issue. I really wore myself out trying to get these people to talk to me. Some of them wanted to, and their lawyers wouldn't let me. Many of them just didn't want to. Of the guys who stood trial and got convicted, the only one who talked to me was John Mariotta. And John Mariotta was a very odd guy and very hard to talk to. I spent maybe 9 hours speaking with him. I sat in his house in Scarsdale. He had built himself a lovely ranch house with the proceeds, WedTech, from the stock and from his theft. And it took about 9 hours for me to get from the time he was born until about 1980. We just kept going over his life story, and he would go off on long, rambling tales of his persecution because he was like a condemned man who could only relive the tale of persecution that he felt he had suffered. And when we finally got close to talking about the criminal acts, he suddenly turned against me. I said something wrong. I triggered something somehow, and I hit onto his paranoia. All of a sudden, he decided I was in league with all the people he thought were out to get him, the lawyers and the bankers and all the sophisticated people who he never understood. So he never answered my phone calls again and never let me talk to him. All of my entreaties went for naught. It was tremendously frustrating. Though I did get an awful lot out of him, of course, in those 9 hours. I also spoke at even greater length with a fellow named Tony Guerilla, who was also one of the inner circle. And he was the accountant genius, and an extraordinary genius he was, because WedTech did manage to fool or at least sufficiently disguise its unbelievably bad books by virtue of this fellow's ledger domain. Now, Guerilla did talk to me at great length. Basically, he gave me a lot of insight into how the company functioned in its latter years. And he's an unrepentant fellow, so he's good to talk to because he's not too much clouded by his conscience. He told me exactly what he did and what other people did. And people who don't have much of a conscience are often very good to talk to that way because they don't mind being straightforward about all their bad acts.
We kept trying to convince Mariotta that you weren't out to get him, but do you think you really were out to get him?
No. I feel that very strongly. I think anybody who reads my book will see that I'm not interested in making the kind of simplistic moral judgments that I think normally go into these sorts of things. I see all of these people as having complicated motives, at least most of them. And if something is complicated, it's more interesting to me than if it's simple and if it's obvious. Mariotta is not a simple person. I don't see him as being just a villain. Quite the contrary. I see him as being a person who is trapped by events. I see many of the people in this story as complicated people who had a strong element of idealism to them, as WedTech had a strong element of idealism to it as a company. My interest was really trying to understand what this fellow was all about and why he did what he did and what he told himself as he was doing it, what he believed about his own actions. And I think that was true of my feelings not only about Mariotta, but about most of the others.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Journalist James Traub, his new book on WedTech is called Too Good to Be True. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.